Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
What verse are we on?
Mainam part arhasi tratum. Brahma bandhum imam jahi. Yosavanagasak suptan. Avadin nishibalakan. Mainam part arhasi tratum. Brahma bandhum imam jahi. Yosavanagasak suptan. Avadin nishibalakan.
Somebody taking the attendance right now for this class? Okay, give me, whoever's doing it, give me a list of the absentees after the class. Yeah. Okay.
Mainam part arhasi tratum. Brahma bandhum imam jahi. Yosavanagasak suptan. Ovadin nishibalakan. Ma'enam. Never unto him. Parta. O Arjuna. Arhasi. Ought to. Tratum, give release. Brahma bandhum, a relative of a Brahmana. Imam, him. Jahi, kill. Yaha, he who has. Asau, those. Anagasaha. Faultless, suptan, while sleeping, avadid, killed, nishi, at night, balakan, the boys. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Lord Sri Krishna said, O Arjuna, you should not show mercy by releasing this relative of a Brahman, Brahma Bandhu, for he has killed innocent boys in their sleep. Purport. The word Brahma Bandhu is significant. A person who happens to take birth in the family of a Brahmana, but is not qualified to be called a Brahmana, is addressed as the relative of a Brahmana, and not as a Brahmana. The son of a high court judge is not virtually a high court judge, but there is no harm in addressing a high court judge's son as a relative of the honorable justice. Therefore, as by birth only, one does not become a high court judge. So also one does not become a brahmana simply by birthright, but by acquiring the necessary qualifications of a brahmana. As the high court judgeship is a post for the qualified man, so also the post of a brahmana is attainable by qualification only. The Shastra enjoins that even if good qualifications are seen in a person born in a family other than that of a brahmana, the qualified man has to be accepted as a brahmana. And similarly, if a person born in the family of a brahmana is void of brahminical qualification, then he must be treated as a non-brahmana, or in better terms, a relative of a brahmana. Lord Sri Krishna, the supreme authority of all religious principles, the supreme authority of all religious principles, the Vedas, has personally pointed out these differences, and he is about to explain the reason for this in the following shlokas. Different societies have different codes of behavior, and they have different ways of presenting those codes. Sometimes some cultures just have an oral tradition, and there are elders or witch doctors who are supposed to know this knowledge of how their society is organized and explain it to others. Sometimes this knowledge is not very systematic or even very rational. Primitive cultures have taboos, things that they are terrified of and prohibit. Just like it's, you know, that tree, the banyan tree, is inauspicious. If anybody touches it, someone will die in his family. Some superstition like that. And they build some primitive cultures that are not very spiritually advanced, that are strongly influenced by the mode of ignorance. This is how the modes of nature work, that people who have similar modes are put together by Maya to take birth in the same time and place. And therefore we have communities of human beings who have similar modes. Each country has its particular modes of nature. I won't start giving racist analysis of which country is better than which other country, and which country is worse, and how, but it's like that. And within even smaller communities, especially primitive people tend to have small communities. Their nation is just their small village of a dozen families, and the people at the other side of the woods, 2 kilometers away, are foreigners and potential enemies. And they speak a different language. 75 people speak one language, and 100 people in the next village speak a different language completely. And they have each their own cultures, their own taboos. And very often these taboos or prohibitions are irrational. They're just superstitions. And they're just made up from no good reason. But that is just like in one culture, it's unlawful or irreligious to marry anybody from the same village. Vedic culture doesn't say you can't marry someone from the same village. But some cultures have that. And you know, it must be the person from the next village or a different village. But Vedic culture is rational. It is scientifically organized for progressive development of the human being. It's not based on the mode of ignorance or the mode of passion. The origin of the Vedic Varnashram culture is transcendental. Chatur Varnyam Maya Shrishtam Guna Karma Vibhaga Shaha. This division of human society into 4 divisions of occupational duties was created by me, Krishna says. It's not a human creation. It's certainly not something bad that we should dispose of in the name of social advancement, that we should have a classless society or organize it some totally different way. In India, the secular movement is not to have a classless society. Indians could not live like that. Indian mentality requires strong sense of who's better than whom, based on power and money. Yeah. So instead, all that the modern Indians want to do in the name of secularism and giving up their superstitious heritage is that instead of the Varnashram divisions, they want to just have materialistic divisions according to who has more education, who has more power. And that makes one man a different kind than another. The man with power is a VIP, and he's treated much differently than everybody else. He doesn't even have to obey the law. He can be a cheat and a thief, but because he's powerful, he's respected. That's modern Indian culture. So that's the taboos and the prejudices of progressive India. Every culture has them, but Vedic culture doesn't. Vedic culture is not based on superstition and prejudice. It's based on scientific understanding of the proper organization of human society. And it was created by Krishna himself. Chatur Varnyam Maya Srishtam. I created it. Guna Karma Vibhagasha. And it's like anything that's systematically organized, it has a basis, principles on which it's organized. Marxism, organization of human society, of course, was on the basis of economy. Everything was reduced to economical questions. So-called spiritual questions were irrelevant and actually just a distraction. Religion is the opiate of the people. It's just a distraction. Real life is economic life. And it's a matter of, we have to get rid of, we have to evolve beyond this capitalism, which is better than feudalism, but now we have to evolve beyond capitalism to socialism and then communism. And then pure communism will organize our society on the principle from each according to their ability and to each according to their needs. So that's an idea. It's a basic principle on which human society is supposed to be organized. Vedic culture also has, and Krishna explains it. What are the basic principles of Varnashram culture? Guna Karma Vibhagashaha. It is the division of people according to their guna and their karma. He doesn't say birth. He doesn't mention birth. That's not of primary importance. Of actual primary importance in organizing the Varnashram society are the divisions of quality and activity. To be, say, a Brahmin, a person should have Brahminical character. He should be selfless, self-controlled, and use his intelligence properly. Have proper capacity for making discriminating judgment about what is right and what is wrong. This is the ability or the qualities that a Brahmin should have. But even if you, by the family you were born in, the upbringing you have, and the way your body and mind are constituted from birth, you may have a basically Brahminical character, but you also need to be trained up in how to behave like a Brahmin. Some families, they may train up the children properly to behave Brahminically, according to actual Varnashram principles. And in others, they've forgotten the actual principles and they're instituting something else, like in our family, for example, I don't mean my family, some so-called Brahminical family, the children are trained up to do some kind of ritual puja and go out and demand money from people for doing the puja. Or they're trained up as professional Bhagavatam reciters. This is the family business. This is a perversion of the actual duties of a Brahmana. Brahmana is not just to use his status to demand donations. That's not what a Brahmin is supposed to do. A Brahmin should perform six duties. Patana, yajana, yajana, dana, patigraha. That verse is in the Manusmriti. These are the six activities that a Brahmin should be engaged in. This is apart from the character of a Brahmin, the qualities of a Brahmin. This is what a Brahmin should do. You may have the qualities, but if you're not trained up to perform the activities of a Brahmin, then you're Brahma Bandhu. Then you're just a family member of Brahmins. You may be a good family member, but you're not a trained Brahmana unless you know how to perform and you actually are performing these six activities. Studying the scriptures, teaching them to others. Teaching can be done by book instruction or by example. Both are modes of teaching. Yajana, you should worship the Lord, the Supreme, and that can be done in various ways. By ritual yajnas, by devotional service, by practice of yoga even. Yoga is meant to be meditation on the Supreme. That's a kind of worship. Yajana, and then you should engage others in the same activities of worship. Brahmins are expert in worship, specialists. But other people who are not Brahmins need guidance, or the Brahmins need to do the worship for them. So that's yajana. And then you can accept charity, but you must also give charity away. If you accept charity, you have to give it. Especially a Brahmin should not keep more than he needs. People may be giving you so many donations, but you're not supposed to accumulate them. Technically, you're not supposed to keep a bank balance, or even a refrigerator, or even a cupboard. You should not keep what you cannot use the same day. That's the actual rabbinical principle. Anything you cannot utilize the same day should be given away. Of course, in the modern age, it's not feasible to be so strict about that, but that is the principle. When we don't have access to the food directly, the food we buy is preserved. It comes from a distant place. It's sitting in a refrigerator, and we buy it old anyway. The principle of only consume what you can obtain on the same day is not so practical. Even the food we eat is old. In the modern, or rather in the so-called progressive Western countries, in America, in the supermarkets, you can buy 10,000, 20,000 different items in a typical supermarket. You can buy 40 or 50 kinds of vegetables and another 20 kinds of fruits. But they're all, almost all of them, at least 6 months old, having sitting in a refrigerator, a freezer for 6 months, or irradiated with who knows what, radioactive treatment. So what we're buying is like the dead corpse of our food. So much variety, but it's all dead. So anyway, to follow the actual Brahminical principle in modern conditions is very difficult, but that is the principle. Only consume what you obtain on the same day, and then if you cannot use it up, give it away. But so-called brahmanas, who are not at all properly trained, they're trained up in a perverted reflection of Brahminical activity, all they know is the fifth of the duties. Pratigraha, except the last one, number six, accepting charity. Dana is giving and pratigraha is taking. But it means pratigraha, not just graha, grabbing, but grabbing reciprocally, pratigraha. You can take because you're giving. If you're not giving, you don't have a right to take. You can demand 20 rupees because you're the Brahmin and you're everybody's guru. But what are you doing? What service are you doing to claim the right of a guru? How are you instructing people? How are you guiding them spiritually? If you're not, in fact, if you're completely ignorant about real spiritual principles, you have no right to call yourself a guru and demand 20 rupees or whatever you're demanding. To be fed, to be given money, you don't have a right. You don't have a real right. You give and then you can take. Give something to people, then you can ask them for help. So that's perverted reflection of the original culture. The real culture is not based on birth. Just because you're born in a Brahmin family, even in a Brahmin family that has a strong, you know, heritage and tradition of Brahminical life, but are you living like Brahmins? Are you trained up to perform all six of the Brahminical duties, and are you actually doing them? Are you studying the scriptures? Are you teaching? Are you giving some people something before you ask for something in return? So guna karma, the real society of varnashrama, is the varnas are divided according to quality, character, and activity, behavior. Therefore, Ashwatthama here is being called a Brahma Bandhu, a relative of a Brahmana. He actually is, Ashwatthama is very intelligent. And he's the son of a very exalted sage, Drona. Ashwatthama is no fool, and he's no ordinary person. It is said he will become the next Vyasadeva. That's not ordinary. There are many sages. I don't know how many rishis there are in the world now, but if you look at the histories of the Puranas, Mahabharata, Ramayana, there's so many rishis. They live in the forest and communities, and thousands of different rishis. So among the rishis who are living in the world, that's just the earth planet, and the rishis have their own planet. It's just full of rishis. Yeah, their own planets. Maharloka, where the married rishis live, and Tapoloka, Jana and Tapoloka, where the celibate rishis live, and Brahmaloka, where the perfect rishis live, or Satyaloka, full of rishis. Four whole planets. And there are lots of rishis on the earth, too. I don't know how many there are now in Kali Yuga. There are some. Special people. And Ashwatthama was born as the son of one of the most special rishis. And he's going to become Vyasadeva, which is like top of the list of rishis, is to be the Vyas, the compiler of the Vedas. Among all the thousands and tens of thousands of rishis on the earth, that places you above all the others to be Vyasadeva. So Ashwatthama is not an ordinary person, but still Krishna is calling him Brahma Bandhu. This defines things. You know, there is discussion, controversy going on among the different persons involved in this drama about what is the position of Ashwatthama and how he should be dealt with. Krishna has his opinion. Draupadi had a different opinion. Bhima had a different opinion. And Arjuna had to figure out how to properly deal with Ashwatthama. But Krishna here is saying something that helps define Ashwatthama's position. He's Brahma Bandhu. Everything else will have to follow that basic definition. He's a Brahma Bandhu, so what do you do with a Brahma Bandhu when he comes, threatening to commit violence? He's trying with all his might. He's using the ultimate weapon, the Brahmastra weapon. He's already, not just thinking about it, but he's already sent it, the Brahmastra weapon, with an evil intent. So what do you do with such a Brahma Bandhu? But it's important, first of all, to define that Ashwatthama is a Brahma Bandhu, not a proper Brahmin, but the family member of a Brahmin, of Brahmins. He's not something less than that. He's not something more than that. He's not a demon, a Rakshasa, a Shudra. He's a Brahma Bandhu. Nor is he a proper Brahmin. He's just the family member of Brahmins. So that puts him in a basic category. Then the questions remain, okay, he's a Brahma Bandhu. Now what do we do with a Brahma Bandhu in this situation? Should he be killed? Should he not be killed? Arjuna promised, I'll cut his head off. And you can, Draupadi, you can stand on his head have some satisfaction in that while you perform the ablutions in the funeral ceremony of your children. Gandiva muktair nishitair upahare twa kramya yat snasyasi dagdaputraha. We already read this. This is earlier in the chapter. Yat brahma bandhu shira atatayina. So actually Arjuna's already used the term brahma bandhu, and he's also atatayi. Brahma Bandhu, but he's come attacking with weapons, with the powerful weapon. So therefore, you should defend yourself, and you have a right to kill, so an atatayi. But a Brahma Bandhu should not be killed. A Brahmin should never be punished by capital punishment, and not even an unqualified member of his family also is exempt from capital punishment. This is the dilemma. And Arjuna is going to hear everybody's opinion and make his decision. What to do with Ashwatthama? The Brahma Bandhu who's also an encroacher carrying weapons. Anyway, Krishna is giving his first opinion. Kill him. Now, why not, since Krishna is the absolute supreme authority, why not just do what he says and no further discussion? We would think that that is the highest principle. Just do what Krishna says. That's generally true, but what if Krishna doesn't want you to do what he says? And you're intelligent enough, like not an ordinary devotee, but a devotee like Arjuna, who actually can sense what Krishna really wants. He knows Krishna intimately. He's a very close personal friend of Krishna. He can tell when Krishna doesn't mean it. And he's sensing it here. The next verse will describe that Arjuna, even being directly instructed by Krishna, exactly what to do, kill him. Is there any way you can grammatically construe that to mean something else? Imam jahi. Well, jahi might be understood in different ways. But anyway, Prabhupada has translated, kill him. I think in the context it has to be understood that Krishna is telling him, or telling Arjuna, kill Ashwatthama. Why doesn't Arjuna do it? Because he understands that Krishna actually has something else in mind. How do you kill a Brahmabandhu? You're not supposed to actually kill him. That, will, of course, you've already read this before. There are things you can do to a Brahmabandhu that are equivalent to killing him. Kshatriya is as good as dead if he's insulted. Sambhavitasya chakir tir. Maranad ativichyate. For someone who is, we're talking about a kshatriya, who has a sense of self-respect, and a kshatriya has to. He has to be proud. He has to consider his reputation. He will die for his reputation. And to lose his reputation is worse than dying. Better to die. Maranad ativichyate, worse than, it's more than death. It doesn't mean it's more good. It means it's more bad. It's worse than death. Death is not a thing that people want. So when you say it's more than death, that means it's something you want even less than death. If you have your choice, you'll take the death. If you're a kshatriya, you'll take the death instead of the dishonor. Now, a brahmana is different. A brahmana shouldn't care about honor and dishonor. He should be beyond that. That's kshatriya business. Brahman should not be too concerned what everybody thinks. He should be concerned what the Vaishnava, what the pure Vaishnavas think, what the Supreme Lord thinks, what his own Guru thinks, and everybody else not too concerned what they think. Everyone may think you a fool, but if you're doing the right thing, a Brahman should be satisfied doing it. Even if his own students reject him. If it's only because he was following his principles and his duty, and the students, out of their foolishness, were not satisfied with him, that's their problem, not his. He shouldn't be dependent on anybody, not even his own students. He should stick to his principles, honor or dishonor. And Vaishya usually doesn't care too much about honor. He cares about money. If someone throws money at him and it falls in the sewer, he'll jump into the sewer and pick it up. He'll wipe it off and stick it in his pocket and be very happy about it. He doesn't care about, you know, reputation. He cares about filling his pockets with money. That's a vicious mentality. But a Brahman also is not too concerned for reputation, because not because he's interested in something inferior like money, but because he's interested in something superior, like fulfillment of duty and perfection of life. That's a Brahman's interest. But a Brahman loses that status, even if he knows the goal of life, and even if he's working hard to do it. If he acts irreligiously, then he spoils it. Then he's not a proper Brahman, functionally. If he acts sinfully, Ashwatthama. It's not that he didn't chant his Gayatri or, you know, ate garbage. I'm sure he didn't. He was a Brahmin. He was following principles. But then he decided, and he was fighting in the battle like everybody else. So killing in the battle is not sinful. That he attacked his enemies, that was his duty. Nothing wrong with that. That didn't degrade him. But what degraded him was this decision to murder the Pandavas in their sleep. Now, he didn't intend to murder anybody else but the five Pandavas. But it was sinful intention to do this at night in the camp of the enemy. That is not proper for Kshatriyas. And what to speak of Brahmins who are acting as Kshatriyas. Not proper after sunset to fight and to go to the camp of the enemy where no fighting is supposed to occur. If your enemy comes to your camp, you should greet him as a guest. And there should be no conflict in the enemy's camp. You fight on the battlefield, not in the camp. It's no combat zone. So, and there's no combat time at the night. So during the no combat time, in the no combat zone, Ashwatthama came with the intention of murdering the Pandavas in their sleep. Suptam, to kill an enemy in his sleep is also very sinful. Naripum hanti dharmavit. One who knows the principles of religion doesn't kill a child, and or does he kill an enemy who's asleep? Suptam. Ashwatthama did this, and because of that, even though what he intended to do was kill the five Pandavas, but that intention destroyed his intelligence. And he found instead the five sons of the Pandavas sleeping, and he didn't recognize the difference, and he killed them by mistake. It was a mistake, but all the sins were compounded already. He was already fallen before he even killed them. So that made him a Brahmabandhu. He wasn't a fallen pseudo-Brahmin before. Now he became. It's a recent fall down. But for that, Krishna says he should be killed. This is Krishna's judgment. But Arjuna is a very intelligent devotee. He's going to think about it and decide what Krishna really intends. Okay, are there any questions or comments?
Explain how the most important quality of a Brahmana is to be the selflessness. Because even he might possess very good intelligence and academic excellence, but if he is too selfish and very narrow-minded, then everything becomes useless. I mean, his whole activity, his life itself is not useful for anyone else. It's just being... So,
if you're selfish... Oh, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
So, it's such a important quality to develop in order to properly be useful. And so how do we practically develop this quality?
By serving others. You develop the consciousness by practicing the activity of serving others. You learn it by practicing it. You get a sense of it. You learn the value of it by doing it. Serving others rather than yourself. If you are greedy and you can't tolerate to share your food, say, you know, you're just always in anxiety, I don't have enough food, and you always hoard it, even more than you can eat, you keep it, and you just can't tolerate giving some of it to somebody else, then you have to break that habit by doing it. Give your food away. Give food to somebody else. Practice that. Practice distributing prasadam that you could eat yourself, but give it to somebody else. So by doing that, you change your consciousness. By doing something, by practice. We have to practice activities of selfless activities. Then we develop a taste for selflessness.
There might be a tendency, especially in this fallen age, that someone might think that I have this knowledge. If I share it with others, that person might become more intelligent than me, and he might he might become higher than me in terms of academics or anything else. So in that case, then he might become more jealous. And yes. So how does he
learn that? That is tamasic. That's a kripana attitude, miserly attitude. That I'll teach because that's my way of making a living, but I'll be stingy about who I give my knowledge to, because especially I don't want anybody to know too much. So I'll withhold information, or I'll even distort information intentionally so that nobody becomes as good as I am and competes with me. My students shouldn't compete with me. That's a stingy, kripana attitude. It's not a brahminical attitude. There's a Brahmin who's too much affected by tamogun. So if you're going to teach, you have to be ready to let your students become better than you. You should actually be happy, and you should encourage it. And do everything to let them become more learned than I am. That was Dronacharya taught Drishtadyumna who was going to kill him, and he knew it. But he did it as his duty, and he did it happily. Taught him how to kill him himself. Kill him, kill Dronacharya. So a real teacher should be willing not only to let your student become better than you, you can even let your student learn how to kill you. Okay. Yes, that's a proper attitude for a real brahminical teacher. Don't be stingy with your knowledge. If you're going to teach, then give your knowledge away. Otherwise, you don't deserve to take what is bigger, a salary, even to take charity. If you're stingy, then you don't have a right to take charity.
You mentioned Drona being a rishi. Usually we know that rishis are, you know, really much higher than simple brahmanas. Or yes. So Drona wasn't in a real sense a rishi or just...
Yes. Yeah. There were some rishis who stayed in the court of the Kurus. Kripa was one of them, and Drona was another. But they were recognized rishis and were treated with proper respect accordingly. But they were also involved in the government, in the politics. Some rishis do that. They give advice. But they stay out of selfish entanglements. But somehow they come to the capital and they give advice to the government. So Kripacharya and Drona were both in that position.
And it's more unusual.
Drona was teaching the princes. Yes.
And it's more unusual for me to think about the rishis as taking the role of kshatriyas.
That's very abnormal. This is things that were happening in the world at the end of Dwarpa Yuga. Mode of passion was out of control. And even the rishis were becoming warriors. A very unusual circumstance. It is abnormal. But here's the one case of it. Parashuram's another case, but they're very exceptional cases. A Brahmin and Rishi Putras acting like warriors. It happens in a few cases.
And another question is about Ashwatthama. You mentioned that him being not an ordinary person. Usually even for ordinary person, you know, just to commit such a crime is very, very bad, but he was not ordinary like this.
So the crime is worse?
No. So what's the reason? Do we know what's... Was it just a reaction to the Pandavas, or just was it his previous, or just his Leela, or how can we know? If he was not ordinary, it's even, you know...
How do we know that he wasn't ordinary, or how...
Well, you mentioned in your class that he was not an ordinary, he was not just...
Well, we know from... Well, there is some description of what he was like. You know, there's a description of Dronacharya and how he raised his family and what kind of boy Ashwatthama was. We know we have some description of that in the Mahabharata. And somewhere we're told about what he will become in the next in the next Manvantara. So if he's going to become the next Vyasadeva, he can't be an ordinary person. It's not like, you know, the way they pick the Dalai Lama. They just... do a horoscope, you know, when it's time to find another one, and somewhere in some village they pick some village boy and make him the Dalai Lama. It's not like that. It's, you know, you have to actually be born in a good family and be properly trained, and then you become a real rishi. Rishis are maybe sannyasis, but they're not born in saffron. They're born in families. They have mothers and fathers. So it matters. If you want to, the best way to become a rishi is to be born in a rishi family. There are exceptions to that. People who became rishis, even though their parents weren't. But it's a great advantage. If your father's a rishi, then you can, it's natural for you to become one also. It's like if your father's a bus driver, it's natural for you to become a bus driver. It just goes in the family. So, did that answer the question?
Yeah, so it looks like this is just like simple fall down or just his misuse of his free feature.
Yeah, why he got like that? Because of his hatred of the Pandavas. He got infected by all that hatred going around. His father was also infected by it. No, I'm sorry, not Dronacharya. The Dronacharya wasn't, I'm sorry. But he got infected, probably by association with Duryodhan. He got infected with hatred for the Pandavas. Drona was on the battlefield fighting because it was obligation. He was maintained by Duryodhan, therefore he had to fight for him. But Ashwatthama was psychologically on Drona's side, and therefore he also became hateful on Duryodhan's side. And therefore he became hateful of the Pandavas, and that was the cause of his fall down. Time to stop. Okay. All glory to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.